You're listening to the Illuminaire podcast, where we dive deep into behavioral health topics and shine a bright light on the forces shaping this industry's future. From research and technology to business and investment and more. Here's your host, Dr. Ronit Molko.
Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Ronit Molko, and thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Illuminaire podcast. Today, I am delighted to welcome back my guest, Chris McGough. Chris, thank you so much for joining us. When we spoke previously, we talked about the three main areas of tension in healthcare: tension between investors and providers, tension between providers and consumers, and the tension between a customer and a client. I'd love to shift the focus of the conversation today to culture and peak performance. And Chris, you and I have worked together a lot and for a long time. And one of the things that stands out to me the most is your quote that culture is the most valuable off-balance sheet asset a company has. Can you share your thoughts on that, please?
I'm going to go ahead and say I think most executives right now understand the value, the importance of culture. Culture eats your strategy for lunch. It eats anything it wants for lunch. It's so powerful, so incredibly powerful. But what is it? What is it exactly? And there's just so much misinformation out there. So culture is a line that a community of people draw. They just draw a line, and that line separates the behaviors they'll tolerate and advocate for from the behaviors they will not tolerate. They will not. So there's always an organization culture, always. There's always behaviors being tolerated and behaviors not being tolerated. But the peak performance leaders are being intentional about their culture. They are being explicit about their culture. They're working with their people to say, what behaviors will we tolerate and what behaviors won't? I'm a consultant. I go from company to company. In a given week, I could be at six different, in a given day, I could be at two different customers. It doesn't take more than a few minutes to start to pick up on the organization culture. Do they show up on time for meetings? It's not about the meetings. It's about them saying, I'll be there at 9. They give their word, and then they're not. So it's a question of integrity. And one thing we know about a peak performance culture, it's intolerant of breaches of integrity. A peak performance culture believes and enforces that what you say, you do. When you say you're going to do it, how you say you're going to do it. That's how they get their efficiency. So culture is incredible. And the neat part is, and I think this is so much good news, there are three points that I'll make. First of all, we now know the elements of a peak performance culture. There are three ways of being and seven disciplines. I won't go into them now, but we know them. And they're all attainable. You can be intentional, the group can be enrolled, and they can have this culture. That's the first point. We understand what a peak performance culture is. The second point is it causes profit. It causes efficiency. It causes growth. It causes trust with the marketplace. It causes trust with the funders. It generates trust, which generates growth. And lastly, it fits people like a glove. People enjoy. They feel good about working in a peak performance culture. It resonates with most human beings. So here we have efficiency. We have growth and profit. And we have this feeling of being right where we're supposed to be and behaving exactly as we're supposed to. That trifecta is so attainable, and it costs almost nothing to achieve. And it has very little to do with technology.
Yeah, I learned so much about this from you when we first started working together, especially, you know, just how I was showing up as a leader and how that was trickling down. You know, one of the first things you taught me was you can't be ending a meeting at 10 a.m. and starting a new one at 10 a.m. And we were just so scheduled, so back to back that you couldn't show up on time because we just were putting too much on the plate. I mean, it makes such a big difference. Of course, culture also works with retention and attrition in businesses, right? I mean, we've seen companies where employees in the most toughest of circumstances will fight for the company and stay with the company because they believe in the mission and they understand what they're fighting for. Is transparency a big part of that? I mean, to what degree should leaders be transparent about what's happening with the business?
Yeah, boy, you're asking the great questions. So I have a little bit of a different view on that. Your question is, to what degree should leaders be transparent about what's happening with the business? So here's what everybody seems to be saying. Oh, the transparent leader, the authentic leader. Isn't it great? And I think it's great a lot of the time. But Rene, you built something really special. I was there. And I think some people in your audience probably are seasoned business people, seasoned business builders. So let's cut through that nonsense. How many times did you realize because of cash availability or performance issues, did you sit with your HR person and say, we're going to have to let these people go? And your HR person says, well, give me a couple of weeks to get everything ready. And then you're walking around seeing these people and having coffee with them, and you're forbidden by your HR person because you're trying to follow a certain path, which is really best for the people and best for you, from being authentic about this. You're basically sitting there in a massive level of benevolent inauthenticity. And, you know, when this COVID crisis happened, I'm working with some absolutely fabulous leaders right now. I mean, people just peak performance leaders. The best is coming out of them. And, you know, during that survival stage, March 14th through approximately like June 1st, when everything was just so uncertain, we didn't know the language, we couldn't get numbers square, we didn't know how long it was going to last, we didn't know how big it was going to get. That was not a time for leaders to be transparent. Leaders had to lead alone during that. They had to issue command and control in ambiguity. People didn't want brainstorming at that point. They wanted hard command and control leadership. That's what they were listening for. Now, those leaders, if you ask them, Rene, they were frightened. They were confused. But the best ones that I've worked with, they didn't reveal that to the masses because the masses were already frightened and confused. They didn't need any more of that in their lives. So I would love to say, like many people are saying right now, oh, the authentic leader, oh, the transparent leader. I think that's nonsense. But I think whenever you can be, you should be. When the circumstance allows you to be authentic and it allows you to be transparent, be authentic and transparent. But when the circumstance doesn't give you that blessing, when it doesn't give you that grace, don't. Go ahead and lead, you know, benevolent inauthenticity, benevolent opaqueness. And peak performance leaders know they have to do both. They have to assess the situation and they have to choose the correct way of being. I mean, I run with some of the best and that's what they're doing.
So you've talked about three ways of being for peak performance leaders. You've talked about, you know, integrity, do what you say you're going to do, be intentional, be persistent. Can you speak to those?
It starts with integrity because integrity make words create world. When you're a person of integrity, when you say, I'm going to increase my market share by 5%, those words generate actions in the real world because it's going to happen. You said it. It wasn't a guess. It wasn't an abstract goal. So you've got to start with integrity in yourself and in your company. When your company says, my BI will be at your house at 9 o'clock and the BI is there at 9 o'clock, they don't get kudos. That's the way it works. So that's the first place. All right. So once we are people of integrity, our words create our world. What I say, I do. Then you get into intentionality. All right. So what are we doing then? What are we going to do? How many strategies you write them and they end up on the shelf and you go back to doing whatever you want? In a peak performance system, since it has integrity, when it writes a strategy, it does the strategy. It's intentional. Now, the interesting thing about intentionality is, I mean, I coach a lot of young people. I don't like it because I go to my, well, what do you want? Oh, I don't know. I thought that's what we were going to talk about. I don't want to talk to you about what you want. I want to help you get what you want. You've got to figure out what you want. And go in your closet when you're not certain on your intention alone, because your friends don't want to hear it and I don't want to hear it. When you have an intention, come on out and tell me what it is. You want to go to Brazil. Okay, my aunt's in Brazil. You know, you want to go to law school. Okay, I got a guy that can help you. But you have your intention allows me to come back to you with gifts that can help you get your intention. But without intentionality, we're in this mindless, inwardly focused nonsense. So intentionality, when you have an intentionality, the world will say, oh, here's how I can help you with that. But when you don't have an intentionality, the world just yawns. So intentionality is really important, especially when intentionality is met with integrity. Now, what happens is you go out in the real world and it presents all kinds of surprises and tripping hazards and things you couldn't figure out. So you have to kind of chuck and jive a little bit. You have to be persistent. You have to persist and persist and persist in your quest for your intentionality because you said you would. When you get those three things together, and I'm telling you, I can walk into a company and feel their intentionality. Or not. And you can be with a person for not that very long and you can get a sense of their persistence. Are they going to break barriers down? You just feel them. And we all know people on their degree of integrity. I mean, do we trust them or not? Because integrity is the source of trust. You get those three things together. Oh my gosh, there's no stopping you.
Very powerful.
There's no stopping you.
So, Chris, what are your thoughts on, you know, there've been a lot of books written and certainly it's been a theme over the last few years, employees first, customers second. This concept of your employees are your number one customer. And if you treat them as you would your top customers, they will then, you know, that kind of filters through to your organization. Your customers will receive excellent service. What are your thoughts on that?
I think those books are written by people that don't run companies. I think those books are written by academic people. You know, we say so many things that sound so good, and I wish they were true. Like, oh, focus on your employees, and your employees will focus on your customer, the authentic leader, the transparent leader. Man, I've been doing this for quite a long time and running businesses, and I don't get any of that stuff to work. Here's what I know works. I know this works. And I'll bet your listeners, when I say this, they'll say, that's nothing new to me. This is how it really goes down. Your company woke up this morning to provide value to a marketplace. Your company, call it Peggy. She woke up this morning and really her desire in life is to meet unmet needs in the marketplace. She doesn't really want to have employees. She doesn't want to have computers. She doesn't want an office space. She doesn't want anything. She just wants to provide value to the marketplace. That's your company. That's the best way to think about it. She knows that marketplace. She feels those unmet needs in the marketplace. She holds those unmet needs as her own. When that marketplace is hurting and wanting something, that company hurts and wants that for them. That's the company. Now, she has to, at times, she has to get people to work inside her company to do things to cause that value for her. But she doesn't want extras. She wants the fewest number of people to generate the most amount of value because that's her focus, the customer, and their unmet needs being met. And if everybody got that we exist for the customer, the soul of the company is the unmet needs in the marketplace. We rose up to meet those needs. If everybody gets that, then you have to understand that if you're working in this kind of peak performance system that is driven to produce external value, if you're there, you're there for a reason. That company can't figure out how to do what it loves to do without you. And it will protect you and take care of you like a vital organ. That means that it will make sure that you have career paths, that your pay is on time, that your pay is scaling, that you're getting trained, that you're making joyous noise, that you're working in a culture that will never compromise your integrity or your morality. But it's because it must, it has to, it has to take care of you because if you leave, it can't do what it really wants to do, which is take care of the marketplace. The company does not exist for its employees. It exists to meet the unmet needs in the marketplace, and it can't figure out a way to do that without these employees. So it takes care of them. It takes great care of its employees in order to what? service the unmet needs in the marketplace. So I take a very different view of that, because I think once you go internal and start making the company think about the needs of the employees detached from the fundamental soul of its business, it goes into an inward spiral, endless meetings about ridiculously unimportant things.
Yeah, I love that reframing. That makes so much sense. So my question about that peak performance company is, does that peak performance company have laggards? Do laggards exist everywhere? And for our listeners, I would appreciate if you would explain that spectrum of, you know, early adopters, late adopters, and laggards.
We can put everybody in your company in five cups. Take 100 people in a company. There's about 3% of them that are visionaries. Any new idea they love, they upgrade the Apple Watch when it comes out, even though their other one is still working. They're great at parties. If a leader comes in and says an idea, they will say they love it. They're commit up until they see something shiny and bright over there. The visionaries are idea junkies. They drive motorcycles. They are so much fun at parties. But they give you a false sense of buy-in because they have no concentration. They have no longitudinal concentration. Very distracted people, but very fun. 3% of your system, 13% of your system, the early adopters. When an idea comes forward, they question it, they challenge it, they push on it. They're activated thinkers, and they want the best for the company. They really, really do. They're the early adopters, 13%. Next to them, it's a bell-shaped curve, is the early majority. These people learned a trick. All they have to do is watch the early adopters. They trust the early adopters to do the due diligence, to push back. Next to them, at about 34% of the system, 34 people out of 100, are the late majority. The late majority don't want to be left alone. They just don't want to, they don't want to miss the train. So whatever the early majority does, the late majority does. They're non-active thinkers. They're followers. Then there's the laggards. And again, it's about 13% of your system. And when new ideas come along, new possibilities emerge, new thoughts, they say, hold on. I have some questions. I want to ask about this. Let's talk about this. I have some information that might be vital to this. Kind of like the early adopters. Here's the difference. When you answer the questions that the early adopters have and you make them whole and right in their thinking, they will lock and load and go. And they pull the early majority and late majority with them. When you answer the questions and the resistance issues of the laggards, they quickly reform more questions and more resistance because that's how they're drawing attention to themselves. They're Debbie Downers. They take the wind out of possibility. And they're dressed in beautiful clothes. They're very intelligent, but they just learn this racket that if I get in the way of anything going forward under the auspices of keeping everyone safe and powerful, I'll get attention. I will get attention. And every one of your listeners, I guarantee, knows what I'm talking about with these laggards. They go off in meetings. They say the same things over and over again. They bring up information at the worst possible time. They're just impossible to get on board. So basically, if you try to fire them, then part of the late majority just refills that bucket. Like every organization is going to, every family, every organization is just got to carry the laggards. You just got to carry them. And the only way you can deal with them is to ignore them. Don't give them what they want. When they pop off in some meeting, they're going to take the air out of the possibility. They're going to go on and on and on and on and on. You just get real close to them. You say, got it. And you say, what do you think? And you go to an early adopter. You just banish them. You banish them mentally because the answer to your question is they will reload. If you get rid of them, somehow the laggard bucket gets filled again. So you just ignore them.
Do you focus on that 13%?
Oh, yeah.
Of your company?
Oh, every company, if the leader of the company has an index card in her pocket and you have your early adopters on it, every morning take care of them. 13% of your system carries the system. This whole thing, we've got to get everybody on board, a consensus. We've got to get everybody to agree. Recipe for disaster. Disaster. Just get your early adopters. You have 100 people in your company, 13 will carry it. 1,000, 130 will carry it. That's the leverage point. That's where you spend your time.
Well, so you talked about, you know, we're talking about employees and customers first. You talked about how employees can try game the system in a value-based reimbursement model. Can you explain that a little bit?
It comes back to culture. It really comes back to, what are you standing for? What really matters? And if you are driven to produce value and your company says that, we make the following things possible for the children and for the families who love those children. We make the following things possible. And we do that by being this way. And we are relentless in our pursuit of that. Your value-based incentive system is for you. You're going to love it. You're going to love it. On the other extreme, and most companies are in the middle, on the other extreme, it's about money. It's about making money and growth and efficiency. You're going to game that value system and never get caught, really. You're just not going to get caught. It's too hard to catch you. So the value compensation model is agnostic. It's sitting there. And it can be marvelous in a peak performance culture, and it can be gamed completely in a toxic culture. Look at the Enron situation. You know, I mean, there's a level playing field out there of rules and laws when it comes to that kind of business. And they just had a toxic culture and they gamed the hell out of it. So I think that the value incentive system is just, it's agnostic. It's just waiting for people to show up. And if they're a peak performance culture, they live in integrity, they have persistence, they're value-based, they live to serve the marketplace, it's going to be a dream come true, Renee. It's going to be a dream come true. It's not a panacea. Look at the way they tried to measure kids. Nobody left behind, and no one left behind. Anytime the feds try to put a uniformed incentive system in, there are just unintended consequences by bad actors. You know, there's this myth that you can build these incentive systems and people won't game them. I've never seen that way. But who cares? Those toxic cultures, they're going to get weeded out eventually. But the real thing that you ask about, and I think it's exciting, is if we can really start thinking about outcome-based indicators, value-oriented compensation, that's going to be music to a lot of companies' ears and a lot of BIs and frontline workers. And if you give that 10% operational discretion, you know, you have a lot of discipline, but you have that 10%, that 10% is going to create magic in the value, and it's going to create heavy compensation. Very heavy compensation.
So, Chris, you know, we've talked a lot about how in behavioral healthcare, technology is lagging. Seriously, you know, we're way behind. And of course, now with COVID, there's been very early and rapid adoption of telehealth, you know, that companies have been trying to get. Certainly in our industry, we've been trying to get insurance companies on board with that for over a decade. Now there's this rapid adoption of it. What do you see as the role of technology in service companies, such as companies like autism service providers or companies finding employment for adults with disabilities or home health? I mean, where does technology fit well and where does it reduce the quality or the outcome of the service?
We should be asking you that question. You wrote the book. You're the expert, Renee. You know that. I'll give you a guess, but then you have to tell everybody whether I got it right or not, because you are the expert. You actually are the expert.
You're the IBMer.
I am the IBMer, and I sold a lot of BS for a long time, to be honest with you. I'm not saying IBM alone, but look, there's something called technology determinism, and you can read about it. Jane Fountain at Harvard writes about it. If any of your listeners are interested, I can give them some links to some really, really powerful writing on technology determinism, which was complete nonsense. Let me tell you what technology determinism is. It is us going into a customer and saying, if you buy and install this technology, the following behaviors will happen. So if you install a CRM, customer relationship management tool, or an ERP, enterprise resource planning tool, if you install this technology, these following behaviors will happen. You will get the following norms, behaviors. Technology, determinism. The technology is determining the behavior. Sold a lot of product that way. Sold a lot of product that way. Until we did the research. And we found something called mutual adjustment. So we go, like, a group is working a certain way and they're getting a certain outcome. So we go in and sell a technology because the owner wants a new behavior. They want a new outcome. So we put the technology in, and the players, the people, look at it and they go, well, wait a minute. We want our old outcome. We don't want the new outcome. We didn't talk about culture. So what they do is they mutually adjust their way of doing things around the technology. They bend it, they twist it, they install, uninstall, so that they can get the old outcome, even with the new technology. It's an extremely powerful dynamic, mutual adjustment. Check it out. So how does this play right now in the COVID world? You know, what's really going on here? Well, as you know, I kind of hang out with some of these people that work in the autism space, and screens are exactly what they don't want because, you know, several of the children that I have relationships with, they live inside of screens.
Right.
It's where they go. Mm-hmm. And so what these BIs, the ones in my little circle, privately now, not my the companies I'm working with, they're very frustrated with it, really. And they don't think the outcomes are there. The billing is there because the payers have adjusted, which we've wanted. But as far as the you know, the developmental outcomes, I'm not hearing good things about the use of screens with people kind of towards the right side of the spectrum.
Right.
Now, the telemedicine world, where you have a relationship with a doctor and you make a phone call and you say, hey, I got this thing going. They say, okay, I know all about you. So I'll call the pharmacy and we'll get you a script. That's a whole different world. And I think we have a lot of potential there, a real lot of potential there. We're utterly failing on providing educational services to elementary kids using technology. It's an utter failure. I can't, this is a long time to be on a computer for me right here with you, and you're fun. You know, I mean, I had a friend just now, she emailed me and said, I just pulled off a 16 hours, back to back days, corporate retreat online. And everybody was in their homes. Come on, no. So I've been a technologist all my life. I started IBM in 1980. I've been building my own technology companies. With the right culture, technology can be amazing. With the wrong culture, my friend Michael Doyle said, technology makes poor process worse faster.
Right. And just speed up bad process. Yeah.
And what I say is technology makes toxic cultures really, really more toxic. Anonymous stuff and all that. So again, I wish I could just be more simple, but I don't think that's the way life works. But technology is agnostic. It's just technology. How it's applied, that's the game. And we just have to really be very, very careful on over-reliance on technology.
Right.
It's never going to simulate a kiss.
It's true.
It's not.
It's a great way to put it. My neighbor has a child in kindergarten, and this poor kid is trying to start kindergarten on Zoom, you know, and it's just extremely painful. It's just not easy.
Go across the way to your neighbor and say, get them out of there.
Yeah.
It's the exact wrong thing to do for a kindergarten kid. Get them into manipulables. I mean, right. The biggest thing that I'm seeing right now are these like little clutches in the neighborhoods, you know, like
pods. Yeah. Pods of six kids. Yep.
Yeah. And they're all tested, you know, they shoot the gun on their fevers and that kind of thing. And then you have this, you know, bunch of blocks and stuff like that. I mean, kindergarten kids on Zoom it's inhumane.
Yeah. So Chris, let's end off with something fun. You've spent over 10 years working at IBM. And when I've asked you in the past what you learned from your time at IBM, the number one thing was to keep a mint in your pocket. But I'm sure there are others. Can you share some of those with us?
Hey, I got in there in 1980. The thing that Renita is bringing up is I went to marketing school at IBM, and you know, it was a week long, well fed, really make you feel like you're something when you go to the marketing training. But you know, at the end, this man, I won't say his name, but he was the best IBM salesperson that we ever had. He had the New York City patch. He had J.P. Morgan. Very, very successful guy. He's going to be our last speaker. And he, you know, we're thinking, here it is. This is Moses coming down from the mountain. This is going to be the 10 commandments of selling. And he's 20 minutes early for his time. Say his time was 1. He's there at 12:30 sitting in the back of the room. So it's finally time for this guy. His name is Bob to come up to the front of the room. And he comes up and he goes, he has a beautiful, not overstated, but beautiful suit on. Shoes were shined. You could see in them. And he just goes, selling? Well, he goes, it's really important to be nice. Because people buy from who they like. Mm-hmm. So you should be nice. And then the second thing is you should never be late for any reason. You should, he's the guy that told me being on time is 10 minutes late. And then he goes, but most important, if your customer offers you a breath mint, take it.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, we had some fun back then. I loved IBM. You know, we didn't curse. We just weren't allowed to curse. That culture, if you cursed, people looked at you like it was weird. And you couldn't overstate the product promises. You know, you had to tell people what the product, you know, kind of thing is. It was... I worked at IBM at a fantastic time. I still don't know why I left. I walked out, 4 kids and no job, and started companies. In 1989, I started to build companies. I appreciated my time with IBM. I really did enjoy it. I met great people. I was fortunate to be like they loved management. All this leadership, 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 leadership. IBM was like management, management. And I was blessed with some really, really great managers. And they valued management, you know, like IBM was led a little bit, but it was managed a lot. 360,000 employees, $60 billion of revenue. So I learned to be a good manager there. And I think one of the things that IBM did really, really well is the way the managers gave you feedback. You know, 3 months into the year, they cozy up with you kind of informal and say, yeah, here's the deltas between what we need out of you and what we're getting. But it was never written down. 6 months in, the manager would sit with you and say, here's where we're at. Here's where you're headed. And then the annual appraisal. And they were real appraisals. They were written. They were constructive. They were generative. And they were helpful. And those managers had the courage to say tough things to you. As I was a young guy, I just got out of college, grad school. I learned management at IBM, the good side of management. So I was really blessed to start in a company like that and then take those principles to small companies, to startup companies.
That's great. Similar to your story about the marketing leader, when I was an undergrad, I was working in Apple Valley, which is about 102 miles out of LA at a traumatic brain injury facility. And I used to drive there every day and drive home every night. Occasionally I would sleep over, but it wasn't that fun sleeping in that hospital. And we had snow, which of course we never get in California. And I called my advisor at the time, my undergraduate advisor, the night before, and I said, it's going to be snowing tomorrow. What should I do? And I expected him to say, you know, don't go. And his answer was, instead of leaving at 5 a.m., leave at 4 a.m. And... I got it. Don't be late. Doesn't matter if it's snowing in California. Just be there.
Renit, I'm so glad to hear you say that. And I hope everybody has the opportunity. I just want to close with a very similar story. I'm a new guy at IBM. I'm broke. I'm driving a 1964 Rambler in upstate New York at a federal manufacturing facility for IBM. And I didn't want to make a mistake with my boss, Ray Dool, and I'm doing a shout out for Ray Dool. I was just blessed to have one of the finest people and managers right out of the gate from grad school. So I call Ray. I go out and it's cold. I lived on a lake and my car's frozen. It won't start. And I call Ray and I still had like, I don't know, 40 minutes before I was supposed to be there. I started at 7:16 in the morning. That was my start time. Where they got that number, I don't know. And I called Ray and I said, Ray, I'm calling you because I went out this morning and my car won't start. And he goes, oh, let me give you a phone number. And he gives me a phone number. And I said, oh, is that a tow company or a garage? And he goes, no, why would I do that? It's the name of a taxi cab company. Get yourself in here. And I was like, whoa, that's not college.
That's a great story.
So it's a lot like yours.
Well, thank you, Chris. I always learn from you. Every time we chat, I learn something new and I have great takeaways over the years. And I really appreciate you sharing your wisdom and your insight and your time with us. Hey. It's been awesome. Thank you.
Honored to be invited. I hope it was helpful to someone in your audience. I know you care about them deeply. I do know that.
I do. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Illuminaire Podcast with Dr. Renit Mulco. If you like what you heard today, please subscribe, rate, review, and share our show with other listeners. See you next week.